This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The U.S. and British military buildup continues in the Gulf. At the United Nations today, Secretary of State Colin Powell told members of the Security Council that they must not shrink from the hard decisions to be made about Iraq in the coming days. And in Baghdad, the chiefs of the United Nations inspections teams concluded 2 days of discussions with Iraqi officials. A possible alternative to war has emerged over the past few days, and a bit later in the program we'll discuss who's behind the latest talk of a bloodless regime change in Baghdad and whether the idea that Saddam Hussein might go quietly into exile is just wishful thinking. We'll also be joined by military analyst Elliot Cohen to talk about the psychological effects of the buildup and whether the movement of so many troops and ships and aircraft makes a conflict inevitable. But first, an update on the meetings in Baghdad. United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the UN's nuclear agency, the IAEA, came away from 2 days of discussions with some new documents and Iraq's promise to be more cooperative. Iraqi scientists, reports say, will be encouraged to meet privately with UN inspectors. Still, broad questions about unaccounted-for stocks of chemical and biological weapons remain unanswered. If you have unanswered questions about what's unaccounted for, the significance of 16 chemical weapons shells found last week, or the character of the inspections a week ahead of the report to the Security Council, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Amy Smithson, Director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Henry L. Stimson Center, which is here in Washington. Thanks very much for coming in today.
My pleasure to be with you.
What do you make of Iraq's apparent agreement today to allow its scientists to be interviewed privately by UN weapons inspectors and to be more forthcoming in general?
Well, I'll say the jury's out, but if one is to look at their past practices, this is a resumption of cat and mouse games. They're only going to give as much as they're pushed to give.
So they are, would it be fair to characterize what they're doing as a minimal cooperation?
I think that's a very fair assessment.
What significance do you attach to the discovery last week? The inspectors found 12 empty chemical warhead shells, then Iraq found itself, found more. Is this material breach, is this raised to the level of smoking gun?
It depends on how one sees the glass of water, whether or not they think that is a glass half full or half empty. And when one looks at what was left unaccounted for, you have to recall that there were literally over 100,000 empty munitions that the previous UN inspectors did not find. So this could be the tip of the iceberg in terms of what remains in Iraq.
Now, when you talk about munitions, these 122-millimeter rockets?
Yes.
And these are battlefield weapons. They have a range of about 12 miles, I read?
Indeed.
So these are not for use against enemy capitals, however close or far away they might be?
Well, chemical weapons are generally characterized as battlefield or tactical weapons. And the Iraqis have a great deal of experience using chemical weapons. They used them a number of times during their war with Iran, as well as against their own Kurdish civilians. They're no rookies at this.
Mm-hmm. We're also seeing wire reports just coming across that as he arrived in Athens, Mr. Blix, the head of the United Nations Weapons Inspections Team, UNMOVIC, told reporters that Iraq had declined, had refused to accept the idea of U-2 reconnaissance flights over Iraq as part of the weapons inspections program. What does that tell you?
Well, again, that's part of the cat and mouse thing. On the one hand, the Iraqis appear to be cooperating, and on the other hand, they're frustrating the inspectors much as they have in previous years. These aerial overflights can really be very helpful in getting the inspectors up-to-date knowledge about what is and isn't being moved from place to place. There's things that you can tell from the air that are much more difficult to tell from the ground, and vice versa.
And these were used during the last inspections regime when it was not UNMOVIC, but the previous group of inspectors.
Correct. When it was UNSCOM, not only were they making use of U-2 overflights, but they were also using helicopters in an effort to make their on-site inspections very timely and not not to give the Iraqis any notice of where they were going to land.
Mm-hmm. And were these, Iraq, certainly during the previous inspections regime, was clearly worried that the efforts of the inspectors were devoted more towards espionage rather than towards weapons inspections. Is there a reason for them to be specially worried about U-2 flights?
Again, this is something that the United Nations, I think, needs to make the best use of, because these are simply assets that the inspectors will begin to rely upon more and more heavily the deeper they dig. They have sensors aboard these planes in addition to, in some cases, especially the helicopters, in addition to photographic sensors. And so these will be able to give them a wide array of information.
Can't they get that same information from spy satellites the United States and others operate?
That depends on how much information the United States is currently sharing with the United Nations about these matters. And my understanding is that they're beginning to share some data, but I would doubt that the floodgates are completely open at this point.
Another thing that was at least thrown into the mix at the beginning was the idea of predator flights. Those are the unmanned reconnaissance drones that we've heard so much about over Yemen and earlier in Afghanistan. Are those being used, do you know?
At this point, I can't tell you whether or not they're being used. I haven't seen public reports to that effect. But back to the point of what's the significance of these shells that have been found. At present, we know that the inspectors are running chemical tests on the shells. And if they come up with a finding that one or more of those shells was previously filled with VX, then I think what some have characterized as a smoldering gun might become a downright smoking gun, because the Iraqis have refused to concede that they weaponized this nerve agent.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go for Steve. Steve's on the line with us from Minneapolis.
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
William Pitt, the author of the book War on Iraq, has challenged the idea that the media for just taking face value that these are necessarily chemical warheads, and you even said that at the beginning of the program, and I think the media should be saying these are alleged chemical warheads to begin with. And he makes the argument that first that they're not chemical warheads in the arsenal of Iraq, that they're a warhead's a warhead, but an empty ordnance space strapped to a missile. And he says that the warheads are stone cold empty, so they're by definition not chemical warheads. And they were, because they were loaded with no payload, so we don't even know that they were necessarily loaded with any chemicals to begin with.
Well, let's...
Second,
can you hold on, Steve? Steve, one question at a time, okay?
I'm sorry?
Can we go one question at a time?
Sure.
Okay, Amy?
The characteristics of the weapons and the munition systems that the Iraqis used for delivering chemical payloads during the Iran-Iraq war and afterwards are very well understood by the inspectors, because they literally destroyed tens of thousands of filled munitions. And what they're doing is trying to track down these weapons, and they will have written down the lot numbers of the weapons and looked for other identifying characteristics that really lead them to characterize them as chemical as opposed to a conventional round.
When they're empty, is there any way to tell the difference?
Well, that's why I'm saying that the inspectors took swabs. They are running tests to see if these weapons were ever filled. But the fact that the munition is empty is not something that I would just dismiss as saying, no, that could never be a chemical round. By no means. The characteristics of those rounds designated to be filled with chemical agent are very well understood.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think that demonstrates that, in fact, we don't know that it's a chemical warhead, and that the media should not be saying these are chemical warheads. We should be saying they are alleged chemical warheads. That's Pitt's argument. And then the second one is that the UN resolutions also do allow Iraq to have a variety of weapons, including this Al-Samud missile. So, I mean, and the third thing is that Scott Ritter informed Mr. Pitt that in fact this was in the declarations made in December. And so, I mean, I just think the media should be very careful, because the Bush administration is very, 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 has been very deceptive in the way in which it's used so-called facts that later on we've come to see, the facts really aren't quite what they look like. We saw this happen in the first Gulf War with the incubator babies and the so-called troop advancements on Saudi Arabia and the like. So I think the media should be careful and just say, well, these are alleged chemical weapons at best. And finally, I think that this shows that the inspections process is working, and that people like Tony Blair and others are actually quite right to be saying, well, we should be letting this take a longer period of time, and there's no need to rush to war.
Mm-hmm.
100,000 people marched yesterday to say, don't march, don't go to war. We should take our time with this, for sure.
Okay, Steve. Again, Amy Smithson, thanks very much for the call. Were the shells that were discovered, were they designed to carry chemical weapons?
That is how the United Nations inspectors are characterizing them. This is something that didn't come out of the White House initially. This is something that came from United Nations inspectors. So we need to pay attention to who's giving us what information before we ourselves get confused in all of this. Remember, we can't talk about this in isolation from Iraq's past behavior. This is a country that has used chemical weapons, flagrantly produced them in the face of inspections and past UN resolutions. And therefore, I think that there's a lot more that needs to be discovered there. And I would agree that this does say a great deal about the inspections working.
U.S. officials over the weekend in their appearances on the various talk shows said, look, we know when a regime is cooperating with weapons inspections. We've done this before in South Africa, in Kazakhstan, in the Ukraine, when those countries voluntarily got rid of, in this case, nuclear weapons programs. And we know what that looks like. It does not look like that in Iraq. Is this an appropriate analogy?
I agree. It is an appropriate analogy because when a country is giving up its weapons capability, they do open up the doors. They produce documentation. They take the inspectors to various places. They allow interviews with key personnel without having somebody sit over their shoulder, literally putting the individual being interviewed in fear of their life or their family in fear of their lives.
Let's go to Natalie, who's on the line with us from St. Joseph, Michigan.
Yes, I have two questions. In one of the public radio broadcasts, defectors have said that Saddam Hussein has hidden weapons in the dunes, which I don't know where those are and wonder if those have been examined. And then since the weapons are short range that we've heard, that they don't really have very long range, are they examining the periphery of Iraq? Because it would make sense then to have their weapons as close to the periphery as possible to be able to deploy them. And then just a third comment, if a war can be avoided so that we don't waste all our troops that we've sent over there, can we use them to distribute aid and food to people in the Middle East who are so needful? That's it. Now, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks for the call, Natalie.
Okay.
All right. So is hidden in dunes, does that mean anything?
Well, there's certainly been a pattern of behavior from the Iraqis with the previous inspections where they hid things all over the place. They hid certain key instruments for missiles in the Tigris River. They have indeed buried things in the sand dunes, hidden them in locations where one would not expect. That's one of the reasons why I mentioned the helicopters before and the sensors that they were flying on the helicopters in the past round of inspections.
You too, you mean?
No, on the helicopters.
I see. Okay.
Because there is a capability to look not just at the surface aboard some of these flights. So I don't know which dunes they're referring to. Iraq is a sizable country. It's a lot of territory to cover, and that's one of the reasons why it's so important to be able to interview individuals without having these Iraqi minders watch over their shoulder, because then you might get more accurate information about where to look. This is a needle in a haystack search.
And briefly, might that needle be, as Natalie suggested, near the periphery of Iraq rather than towards the center?
It might. This is kind of like the game Battleship, you know, where you sit there and you position your battleships where you think your opponent is least likely to guess where they are. And some people have said they might be using the palaces for hiding munitions or documents, ditto mosques or schools. They're trying to really play a shell game here, and it's one that they've played before to great effect.
Amy Smithson, thanks very much for coming in today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Amy Smithson is director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Henry L. Stimson Center, and she joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about momentum building to drive Saddam Hussein into exile, wishful thinking. Call us, 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255, our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.